Hi everyone, welcome to the Post Bougie Podcast for September, the week of September 5th, 2010. This week, this is Shawnee in not Central New Jersey, in D.C., and I am joined by Monica of The American Prospect.
Hello.
Janelle of The American Prospect.
Hello.
And Nicole, one of the newest members of Post Bougie, who is who works in food policy.
Hello.
And Nicole's also in D.C., so it's all D.C. all the time. So yeah, we're just going to get started and launch into the first topic. This week we are going to be talking about a post that Monica wrote for Feminist. She's guest blogging there. She's been guest blogging there for the last 2 weeks, I think. And it's kind of about the usefulness and not usefulness of the body mass index, or BMI as it's more commonly known.
Okay, so let's just start off by saying that I probably approached writing this post as I would writing a post at Post Bougie, and so maybe my tone was a little off for the particular feminist audience. But let me just outline the general idea of what my post said, and then we'll get into what it spawned. But basically, a doctor wrote in the New York Times about how the BMI is useless as a tool for personal health, which is true and always has been. The important thing about personal health is what that person's weight is compared to their height is one aspect of it, but also their, you know, other statistics and the amount that they exercise and the amount that they eat. But BMI is useful as a broad population tool. And so some populations just have higher BMIs and some populations just have lower BMIs, but we've used it for so much now that we generally kind of know what's going on when we talk about populations with the BMI, and its usefulness is primarily as a public health tool to see how populations are changing over time. So it's a really crude measure. It was arrived at in ways that are problematic, and so people want to discontinue the use of BMI. But as far as what is easy to use and does tell you something kind of broadly about a population as a whole, so we can say that the American public as a whole has had an increasing BMI for a long time, and that tells us something about changes in our behavior and our diet and our health as well. And that's just kind of broadly true. And I also said that even though that is true, it doesn't mean that weight doesn't have a place in discussions of personal health. But I think
so. Then what happened?
Well, what mainly happened is that. Every single commenter on the Feminist blog disagreed with me, but not just as I expected people to say, no, you're full of shit. The BMI is completely useless. And I would say, no, I think you're wrong. Here's why. Like a discussion we would have on PB. What I didn't expect was all these comments were basically like, fuck you and the fuck the truck you came in on or whatever. I'm apparently a woman hating person. And all of this actually, I just will have to say, centers on the fact that I used probably some impolitic language toward the end where I said, weight can be a signal of a lack of exercise and too many donuts. What I meant and what I should have said, because it probably would have been a more tactful way to put it, is that weight can be a signal of an unhealthy lifestyle. And there's nothing wrong with that. I said it irks people. It shouldn't irk people.
Because people don't know how much you love donuts.
That's exactly the other problem, is that people don't know about my horrible sweet tooth.
Yeah.
But what I meant by that, too, is that, like, that really doesn't – it's not, like, evidence of some moral failing on the part of the American populace. But it is evidence of a problem. Like, Americans overall have a really unhealthy lifestyle. One of the ways we know that is because we have this BMI statistic that tells us we're getting larger. We have a lot of other statistics that tell us that we're getting larger. And I think it's a bit burying your head into the sand to say that weight and increasing weight and much broader levels of obesity than we've ever seen before are completely unrelated to the expansion of diseases that have always been either proven to be related to obesity and fat cells in the body, or at least like linked to obesity and fat cells in the body. So, I mean, we have kids now who have a disease that we used to call adult onset onset diabetes that we knew was related to weight. Mm-hmm. We have kids with kidney stones that we know is related to too much sodium in the diet. I mean, all of these things are, it's not ridiculous to point that out. I think,
well, I think if anything, the one thing in your post that I think a lot of people took offense to was the fact that you said that you had never been like heavily criticized by a physician for being overweight. And then a lot of people
said I've never been criticized by a physician. I said they've never like talked solely about my weight.
Okay. It just seemed like a lot of people came in and said, you know, you're lucky, but my doctor has like come down on me hard about my weight.
You know, like, of course, right, that, like, women's bodies are, you know, like, our culture traditions, women's bodies in really problematic ways. That's sort of a given. And I think what's sort of happened in some quarters of the fat acceptance movement is that observation has sort of, like, overshadowed every other concern.
I would say that another central tenet of what they do in their postings and their writings is question the science behind obesity and its correlation with health as well. They spend a lot of time trying to prove that all of these measures are just completely bullshit.
Right, and that's what I mean when I say that sort of like the observation that women's bodies are treated in really problematic ways and that we don't, you know, our culture tends to treat thinness as analogous to health and, heaviness is analogous to unhealth. You know, I think that those core and correct observations have sort of like distorted a view of empirical data health that I think is reflected in the criticism of Monica's blog post. Like, it's one thing to say that our ideas of health are influenced by culture and contingency. Agreed, everything is. But it's, you know, it's undeniably the case that a healthy person should be able to do X, Y, and Z things. And people who can't do X, Y, and Z things probably aren't healthy. If you're overweight, that does not mean you could run, you know, X number of miles in X amount of time. You could be perfectly healthy and do that. But it's really crazy to say, I can't run X number of miles, X number of time, but that doesn't mean I'm not healthy. That's just a cultural construct. It's like, no, a healthy person should be able to do that, actually.
Well, what's interesting to me in this discussion you find is a lot of people bring up outliers. Like, they'll say, you know, there are fat people who lift weights all the time, or, you know, who are former bodybuilders or whatever, now they're fat. And then they'll bring up like skinny people who chain smoke and don't eat vegetables as like examples of people who are thin and are not unhealthy versus people who are fat and healthy. But I feel like the problem with bringing out these outliers is that they're still just outliers.
Right,
they're not
right.
They're not actually signed to the general populace.
Oh, I was going to say, to take a step back from whether BMI matters at all in the first place, the thing that struck me about the comments is that, and one of the commenters, and I can't find who it was, nailed it, that a lot of the comments sort of made it sound like this isn't even a discussion that we should be having, we shouldn't be talking about it at all, like how dare you bring up the fact that there might be a relationship between being overweight and being unhealthy, or being obese and being unhealthy. Like, a lot of the comments just sort of seemed like an automatic gut reaction, like, no, we can't talk about this. And one of the things that this commenter, who I really wish I could find, I think nailed in saying that, or not we, but there's sort of been an agreement that because this is a feminist blog and because of the comment, the like community that the commenters have built, we're just not going to talk about this. And this issue is sort of like off the table and we have a consensus about it and we don't have to talk about it anymore. That was the thing that really struck me, is just that immediately people started piling on, I think, without giving any thought to what you were actually trying to say. I mean, the gist of the story is BMI is not a very useful indicator on the individual level. Like, I don't think that's that insane of a statement. Like,
and that's not anything that they disagreed with either. Like, that was something that I think everybody in the thread agreed on, but they were just so blinded by other things in the post that they totally ignored that that was the main thesis of it.
I mean, but I think Nicole's right that, like, the thing that they were enraged by was a suggestion that weight could have anything to do with health. Which strikes me, I mean, you know, I have no investment in the value systems community. It strikes me as absolutely insane to claim that weight has nothing to do with health. Like, that strikes me as approaching the level of, like, tooth fairy beliefs, right? Like, certainly there are a lot of people who believe it, you know, more power to you, but I'm sorry, like, every available shred of empirical evidence suggests the opposite, and I'm going to go with the numbers.
I will just say, too, a lot of people referred me to this site, First Do No Harm, which I knew about. I also knew about Kate Harding's Shapely Prose, and she is a blogger who at Shapely Prose who was, you know, really critical of me today. But, you know, this site, First Do No Harm, is a collection of stories of, you know, patients being fat shamed by their doctor. And I, you know, people's personal experiences, especially in the doctor's office, are really, really often traumatic. And I know that, and I don't want to say that, but some of the experiences are people saying that they need a fat understanding doctor because, this one woman's post, she was saying that she has a healthy thyroid test. Every time she gets her thyroid tested, it's tested as healthy. But she needs a doctor who understands that that doesn't mean she doesn't have hypothyroidism. And she needs a doctor who understands that even though she's not testing for it, she has hypothyroidism and that's the cause of her weight gain. And that just strikes me as a doctor not telling you what you want to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's delusional.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying that that's what's going on in different cases, but like, also, and people think of health as a really, really personal issue, but in some respects, it's not. Public health is a public health issue, and especially the more we talk about health insurance on a societal scale, what we do broadly as a population is going to be more and more discussed, and that does not mean that you are personally being attacked. And I think that was one of the things that struck me about the response to my post as well, is because that's what I was trying to say. And I'm also, like, Americans have an unhealthy lifestyle. I write about and understand all the time about the structural and problems and socioeconomic problems that lead to an unhealthy lifestyle. But that doesn't mean that I think that's true in every case. And that's really what strikes me about Shapely Prose. The blogger I mentioned earlier, Kate Harding, has a slideshow of photos that are meant to show how subjective and odd the BMI is as an indicator. And every single person in that slideshow is white.
Mm-hmm.
Which
I noticed
also
that too, looking at it. It was a little problematic for me.
And I would just say too that, like, and you know, not to make this like personal in a way that is trying to counteract my own personal experience with other people's, but public health issues matter to me because I grew up in a really, really poor area where there is no social expectation that anyone would be active and where it's really hard to get good food and people are really, really overweight and they die before they're 60. And the idea that there's a movement that would undermine health efforts to help people be healthier by saying that it's that those people are just fine and there's no correlation to weight and health, really, I also think are somewhat dangerous.
No, I completely agree. I have this like tendency to get really polemical against like things I really, really, really disagree with. And this kind of like gets to that. I sort of see some elements of the fat acceptance movement as not being that far away from the anti-vaccination movement. This sort of refusal to take the scientific consensus at its word, or like trust, you know, the combined forces of peer reviewed and empirical data that say that vaccination has nothing to do with autism. Like, I don't care if someone personally believes that, but when you make a concerted push to convince lots of people that that's true, the inevitable result is that kids are going to die.
And like, I agree with you, but I think that less of an I think it goes back to what Monica was hinting at earlier about the intersection between public health and private health. Like it's really, really hard to get the two to agree because a lot of times what's really, really good for public health, i.e. vaccinating everyone's kids, is not necessarily the best thing for you as an individual privately. Like if you have, there's some vaccinations that I don't take because I have had terrible reactions to them or whatever.
Right. I mean, I'm
but
just saying.
What's good for, I think that it makes me a little, I don't want to say that they, I don't condone the anti-vaccination movement. I think it's stupid, and I think that you are putting your life and other people's lives who have no choice in the matter at risk. But it bothers me a little bit to sort of just use the evidence to go on that. It's such a personal decision.
I mean, the point of the comparison was to say that, like, in much the same way, for some individual people, sure, it's cool, like, go ahead and don't, you know, if you feel that you're healthy at whatever weight you're at, like, more power to you. But, like, trying to create a groundswell of support for the idea that there isn't any correlation between health and weight seems to me like a surefire recipe for, like, harming lots of people for whom there is that correlation.
I mean, one thing that I couldn't help thinking about was, like, if you're on the internet generally, if you're on the internet and you made your way to a feminist blog, you're probably middle class. You're probably relatively well off. You probably, if you don't have health insurance, you probably have had it at some point in your life. Like, it's not a foreign concept to you. And the issue is, like, you know, you see these high levels of obesity in poor areas, people who've never seen a doctor to tell them, hey, you need to lose some weight. You know, people who don't have access to the kind of foods that promote good health. And pushing this idea that there's no correlation between fat and, or between size and health is just really distressing to me when you look at people, women of color in poor communities who are dying of health related issues that have to do with their size, like diabetes and heart disease. And it just seems really myopic. In that way, the fat acceptance movement seems really myopic to me.
And all of these commenters too were talking, I'm not all of them, but many of them were talking about going to multiple doctors. Yeah. And that to me is like a place of privilege. I mean, you know, that's what bothered them the most, is they felt like I was coming from a place of privilege and I really needed to think about what it's like to be a skinny person, even though I'm not really skinny. So I'm glad, you know, the internet completely changed.
Yeah, don't you love it when the internet decides that they know all about you?
I know, yeah. I'm just like completely a totally skinny person and I don't know what I'm talking about. You know, that but to me they're coming from a real place of privilege. Like I was like a super fat kid, and it's because we were really poor and we drank Coke every day instead of drinking milk. You know, and I don't have a problem with that being the truth. Do you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't mean that we were bad people.
Right. And that's where I kind of understand why fat acceptance activists and people who promote healthy at every size, why they get so upset. Because there are people who demonize fat people for being fat, who demonize people who are overweight and say, well, you should be eating this instead of eating that. But something I think we talk about all the time on the blog is how difficult it is for people to have the healthy eating habits that we tend to see as virtuous. Like, it's not that easy. So, you know, I don't think any of us would say, like, would look at an individual fat person and say, well, this is why you're fat, you know? Like, I think it's pretty clear that it's not that simple, but I don't know. It's a complicated issue. All right.
I mean, I guess it's a complicated issue.
I mean, there are like multiple factors that lead to people being overweight. That's what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like, I mean, but it's like weight gain has many factors. Weight loss is hard. Some people who are heavy are healthy. Some people who are skinny are not. On average, people who are slim are healthy. People who are really heavy are not. And you should make fun of fat people. I don't see what's so controversial about any of those things, but I'm also really glib about stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's my problem. I'm just a little bit glib about stuff. That clearly came across.
Yeah. Alrighty. Well, let's pack it up and move on to the next topic. Because we talked about that a lot. So this week, actually a few weeks ago, Jamel.
Last week.
Wait, what?
It was last week that I met the.
Oh, really?
Is that?
Okay, well then last week, Jamel came home, my roommate came home with this book, American Taliban, and I think we were watching, like, Friday Night Lights, and Jamel proceeded to interrupt us every, like, 5 seconds to tell us how ridiculous this book was. And so this week, he actually posted a review on the American Prospect about it, and it's kind of picked up a lot of it's gotten a lot of traction. Like I think people were waiting for like a liberal to criticize Marcos Valesis, and you were that liberal, Joelle.
Yes. So like the short of it, for those who haven't read the book, haven't just read the book, never heard of the book, the short of American Taliban is that the right wing in the United States, or the radical right, in Coase's language, is
and Coase being Marcos Melitzas.
Sorry, Marcos Melitzas, who is the founder of Daily Coase,
which is a super liberal website.
Right, kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
So I'll just read like sort of the quote from his book. It's that the right wing and where was that quote? Basically, right wing and the Taliban are about the same. The Taliban are exactly what we see in the Republican Party as the GOP continues to consolidate power, et cetera, et cetera. But I should say that there is the space to make comparisons between the right wing and the Taliban. Like, other writers have brought this up in sort of a conversation around the book, but, you know, it is true that Islamic fundamentalists and their Christian counterparts are hostile to women. It's true that they're hostile to homosexuality. It's true that they hold beliefs that border, that either are theocratic or border on the theocratic, and so on and so forth. All of those things are true. Of violence, our own homegrown right-wing extremists and Christian fundamentalists are really enthusiastic about violence. All those things are true. And in some sense, the difference between the two groups is one of degree and one of time. But as Matt Iglesias made this point, the differences of degree are so large that they're effectively differences of time. And that's sort of what I'm arguing, that it's, you know, irresponsible to say that Republicans are just like the Taliban when, frankly, Republicans aren't throwing acid in the women's faces. Like, Republicans, for all their horribleness, are still operating within the democratic framework of government. And while we may disagree with their actions, it's unquestionably the case that, like, their actions have democratic legitimacy, which isn't the case for the Taliban. And it's, like, really offensive to victims of the Taliban and, I mean, to right-wingers to say that they're equivalent, which is what Coase is doing. Some of his defenders, like Digby at Hullabaloo, have argued that this is sort of like Coase is ringing the warning bells and sort of being hyperbolic for the purpose of rallying the troops. But I've read through the book pretty carefully, and the impression I get is that, no, Coase really believes this. That it isn't just like a punch in the face to the right wing. I mean, it's that, but it's not just that. It's also that he really thinks that you can make a moral equivalence between the two groups. I mean, he concludes the book by, like, noting the foundational kinship between the, quote, American Taliban and the actual Taliban. And so, in the review, all this culminates sort of an observation, and that is that while it's really tempting to use this sort of language to attack your opponents, I understand it, they do it to us, that I don't think it's actually been that successful. And this is sort of where I think a lot of the criticism of your review, like, centered, or what they focused on, was my claim that conservatives haven't actually gained from their willingness to bend and misrepresent the truth. Digby points out that, you know, for the last 30 years, conservatives have had a remarkable electoral success beating up on liberals and demonizing liberals and minorities and gays and so on and so forth. One of the front pager at Daily Coast responded, made that same point, noting that, but I don't think that's true. Like, yes, liberal is kind of a dirty word, thanks to conservatives. And yes, you know, there, over the last 30 years, there have been these moments where conservatism is really strong and really electorally powerful. Of the last, you know, one, two, like six presidential elections, conservatives have won pretty much all but Clinton and Obama's wins. But it's also the case that the signature domestic achievement of the Bush administration which by any like counting to conservative Republican administration was Medicare Part D, which was a huge expansion of Medicare, the welfare state. And it's also the case that the Affordable Care Act is a huge expansion of the welfare state. And that when Republicans were arguing against the Affordable Care Act, they were like arguing we shouldn't do it because it might cut Medicare, like implicitly accepting the idea that the government should provide health care to some people. Like, if you zoom out from sort of like the individual battles, it's really clear that like conservatives are still fighting on our turf. And I think that, you know, if liberals can take that path if they want, but they should know that it's not going to work out very well.
Well, I saw a few people who agreed with you, like Ta-Nehisi and Iglesias, and a few people who disagreed with you.
Yeah.
Like Digby and Hunter on Daily Coast.
Can I say, with Hunter's case, I thought it was hilarious that he didn't actually, like, say my name?
I did find that amusing. I really enjoy it when people do that, like, when they, like, spent, and he or she wrote, like, a good 2,000 words, like, complaining about what you wrote, but didn't actually say your name.
To me, that's a sign that I won the argument. If you can't even mention it, then I already won.
I will ask you this. Do you think Republicans have done a good job of demonizing the government in any way in the public's mind? Just because, I mean, they haven't successfully shrunk the size of it, and they haven't really rolled back the welfare state on a national level. But on the state level, you do have a lot of Democrats talking about cutting spending.
Yeah. I mean, so...
In a way that assumes that that's a good thing.
Right. As far as, like, demonizing the government is concerned, and I think probably people will cite sort of, like, healthcare reforms and popularity and everything. Like, there are things we know about the public's relationship with government programs. The first is that Americans love to say that they want to cut spending, but when asked to identify places to cut spending, they always come up short. They always go to foreign aid, which is, like, in their minds, like, half the budget when it's, like, a minuscule portion.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the vast majority of Americans cannot identify a single program they want to cut, which suggests to me that, like, all people, you know, when they get something good, they want to keep it, their rhetoric notwithstanding. The second thing is that at every juncture where a government program was – a new welfare state program was proposed, a majority or plurality of the public opposed it. Medicare was really unpopular when Johnson proposed it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the only exception to this rule is sort of the New Deal, and that's because the economy was so shitty that, you know, it was great. I think, you know, the pattern is people don't like it, they get it, they realize they really like it, and they don't want to get rid of it. And then the conservative opposition calibrates in a response to that. So 20 years down the road, you'll probably have some conservatives defending the, you know, universal American health care against some new proposal to expand it, like to illegal immigrants.
I think that's true. I think where maybe Republicans have made inroads is on the messaging war. I mean, because I think we saw this during the healthcare debate where, you know, the guy famously said, keep your government hands off my Medicare. He likes that program, and he doesn't understand that it's the government and it's his taxes paying for it. And, like, that to me is a bit of a liberal fail, because I think if you read a lot about, which I just happen to be doing now, you know, FDR and his several presidencies and then the presidential terms and the time right thereafter, people wanted during that time a really strong central government. There was, like, really broad support, and there was actual some conversation about whether it was appropriate for Roosevelt to be sort of a dictator because the country was in such dire straits. And I just think that I think the opposite is the message that is popular now.
No, I mean, it's like, I think Americans have always had sort of a rhetorical commitment to the idea of small government. And I kind of think, insofar that the 30s were different, it's an outlier.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, the circumstances are just so weird. I'm not sure we should really sort of, like, look to it as being instructive, as far as, like, rhetorical choices are concerned. And you know, it's also true that as far as messaging is concerned, liberalism is actually a little harder to, like, boil down into a few bullet points than conservatism is. And that's not a dig against conservatives. That's simply saying that the conservative vision is very easily digestible. Small government.
Mm-hmm.
Government should do A, B, and C, and then everything else it shouldn't do. But liberals don't have that same, like, liberals don't have that mirror philosophical commitment to big government. Liberals aren't just like, big government, we want it all the time. They're, you know, big government might be nice, government might be nice here, but like, we can let the market do things here,
mm-hmm.
and sort of like, it just depends on what's most appropriate for the circumstance, which you can't boil down.
Yeah.
You sort of have to find some other way of articulating, you know, where you stand. And because of the kind of inherent pragmatism in American liberalism, it always sounds muddy when compared to conservative messaging. Like, I almost see that as unavoidable. Like, conservatives, like, so, to be really nerdy, when I was in high school and did policy debate, it was sort of taken as a given that the easiest task was for the negative team. Like, the affirmative team has to prove every one of their propositions. The negative team doesn't. They just have to disprove one of the affirmative teams, and they win. I think conservatives are in a similar position. All they have to do is sow doubts. They don't have to put forth a positive program, as we've seen. They just have to sow doubts. And liberals have the... Because liberalism is more of a governing philosophy, liberals have the obligation and responsibility to put forth and articulate a program. And that's hard. So.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Okay. So, let's chug along to the third topic. It's summertime, and...
Summertime.
Yes. And a lot of people are, like, on vacation or trying to eke out their last vacation of the summer, and the Obamas are no exception. While Michelle Obama has been pretty stylish, especially when she was in Spain, she was looking pretty fly. Her style does not seem to have rubbed off on her husband. He has to have at least 7 pairs of dad jeans. Like, that's what I've decided.
You know, I Googled some pictures of him just so I could, you know, so I could be prepared for the podcast. And I came to the conclusion that he's good when he's in a suit. And he's good when he's wearing, like, khakis or chinos or something like that. Like, I think there's a picture of him getting on the plane to go to Martha's Vineyard, and he's got on, like, blue khakis and, like, a button-down shirt, and he looks fine. And then he puts on those jeans, and it's just, like, any sartorial sense just flies out the window. Like, I can see Michelle cringing every time that she's it's just all of a sudden, like, it makes my head hurt.
It upsets me. I mean, it upsets me for the same reasons. But I have this belief that for men, dressing well isn't actually difficult at all. It just requires a little forethought and a willingness to spend more than $20 on any given item of clothing. And President Obama has the advantage of, like, being built well for clothes. Like, he's tall, he's slim, like, he could wear any number of clothes very, very well. He has no excuse. He has no excuse.
So
I wonder if, we talked a little bit about, there was the flap last summer where Michelle had the gall to wear shorts.
Yeah, short shorts.
Like, I mean, not even short shorts, like normal length shorts, and everyone was up in arms about it. So
right.
I wonder if maybe because everyone has paid so much attention to what she's wearing and who she's wearing, and even to a lesser extent what Sasha and Malia are wearing, if he feels like he's not supposed to wear anything all that interesting or cool, or if he's trying to look like my grandpa, I don't know.
I'm gonna blame Real America for this one. Like, those middle brow motherfuckers.
Oh my. Wow. I mean, I will say I think the makeover of the Oval Office also is kind of like, eh. Like, it's definitely trying to look like somebody's living room, and I feel like he's just trying to look like somebody's bad golf partner.
It is a little jarring to me because Michelle is so stylish. Even when it's a miss, you can tell she put in, like, effort to miss, Whereas, like, when you juxtapose them side by side, he's almost never as good looking as she is.
Although, I'm looking at pictures of them right now, and she's riding her bike, and there's another picture of him riding his bike, and the contrast is just night and day. Like, she's in a pair of, like, khaki capris, and like, looks really cute, and just sort of, like, and not, I hesitate to use this word, but not inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Like, not, well, whatever, I'm just going to throw it out there. Not inappropriate. And then the next picture is him, and he's in the, like, ill-fitting dad jeans that look like they're about to fall off of him without the belt, and, like, the washed-out polo, and it just, and the girls always look really cute. It just makes me sad.
I'm going to actually go out on a limb and say that he's not wearing dad jeans, that he's actually wearing mom jeans. That he took.
I'm going to agree with that, yeah.
He took a wrong turn.
At the dad section?
At the parent aisle.
And ended up in bad idea jeans, basically.
Yeah.
The day that I see black socks and sandals, I don't know what I'm going to do.
I think it's going
to happen. It's going to happen.
Maybe Barack Obama is trying to get in touch with the last... like, having gone to the Tea Party event last weekend, I can safely say that there are many Americans who have never met a pair of clothes that fit.
I'm going to say that that's true. Like, I didn't know how clothes were supposed to fit until I went to college.
And I'm going to say that Barack Obama was trying to get in touch with those people.
Okay.
I mean...
Hey, I look just like you. We can be friends.
We can be friends.
That might be true. It might also be true that, like, maybe we shouldn't want our president to spend a lot of money and time buying clothes and putting them on and making sure they fit.
He can hire, like, a presidential stylist, you know?
See, I disagree with that, Monica. I think that, like, if he was dressed really poorly, like, as opposed to just, like, middle America poorly, people would be really upset about that. Like, you know, like, they have to walk this fine line between being well-dressed but not too well-dressed. And Michelle, I think, crosses the too well-dressed line every once in a while.
I'm glad she does.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It's a tough one. But, like, you would never see... Wait, who's the new Prime Minister of Britain?
David Cameron.
David Cameron dressed like that. I'm still stuck in the Tony Blair days.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't know enough about the day-to-day of European politics to really, like, make this... like, safely say this. But it seems like... because they're heads of government and not heads of state... Mm-hmm. They may not be necessary. It's not so much necessary to, like, represent their people, right? Like, Tony Blair, like, the Queen represents the people. Tony Blair is just some dude who, like, carries out the government.
I think there's also a higher expectation of formality.
Yeah,
he's Britain too. Sure. Like, you're supposed to wear a suit, and you're supposed to be, you know, if anything, more formal than you should be, versus here, where I think there's an expectation that things are supposed to be a lot more casual, and that the president is supposed to be somebody that you want to have a beer with, and, like, a little bit more relatable.
See, I went back during the primaries, and people were like, Obama seems like he just has contempt for everyone. I was like, good, good. Obama's Obama's trying to be the most powerful man on the planet. He should have nothing but contempt for us.
I mean, I'm going to agree that I think Obama should have much less faith in the American people that he's always trying to approximate with his clothing, but...
Yeah. Agreed. All right. Well, yeah, I feel like we're just condemned to the remainder of his term. There will be a lot of dad jeans or mom jeans.
I just want a polo that fits. So that's really my only request. It's a small one.
Seams on the shoulders. It would be nice. Maybe we should send him one.
Yeah, and his collar needs to not be so relaxed.
Okay.
Prediction, the first gay president in the United States will be our worst dresser ever.
first openly gay president.
First openly gay, yes, because there are other presidents who may there have been over 40. Chances are one of them has been gay. My money goes to James Buchanan, just throwing that one out there.
My money sort of goes to Truman.
Yeah, Obama dresses terribly. He needs to work on that. I mean, I can't blame Michelle. I blame Michelle every time I see a picture, but I feel like maybe it's not her fault. I mean, he probably has some autonomy in how he dresses. So
maybe once the girls grow up, they'll be like, Dad, listen, this can't happen anymore.
Yeah. Alrighty. So let's wrap it up by doing our shout outs. Monica, what are you shouting out this week?
I'm going to shout out the new iPhone and iPad app for Netflix. Jamel and I were playing with it in the office, and I was concerned in the beginning that it allows you to watch Netflix, watch instantly selections on your device. And I was concerned that this was going to rely upon a really good wireless connection, which isn't always easy to get on public buses, which is where I usually try to watch TV shows and stuff. Or inner city buses. And, it doesn't. It goes over the 3G network. And so it's calibrated to not like stop every 2 seconds. It's amazing. And it's going to change my life. So if anyone has and it's also free. So if anyone has the ability to download this application, I say do it ASAP.
Okay. So wait, does it like affect, cause don't you have limited download, like limited bandwidth now?
It depends. Like if you, like, Monica got an iPhone way back, and so she's still on an unlimited plan. And AT&T has given all of its iPhone users, or any smartphone user, the option of just staying on your unlimited plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Monica, it doesn't matter if she can watch as much. Well, technically, your unlimited plan is 5 gigabytes. I think that's sort of industry standard.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as Monica doesn't go over 5 gigabytes, AT&T doesn't really care.
Mm-hmm.
For me, since I, downgraded my plan to 2 gigabytes because I wasn't using nearly enough to justify the additional cost.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to watch like a movie, a 2-hour movie on 3G, it'd probably eat up a quarter of my bandwidth for the month. But I've just been using it on Wi-Fi since Wi-Fi is pretty available. And most of the places where I'm waiting for long enough to like watch something have Wi-Fi. So yeah, like a one Wi-Fi doesn't eat up your bandwidth, and it looks fantastic on Wi-Fi, no less.
Cool.
It's pretty amazing.
So Jamel, what's your shout out then?
My shout out is the Nikon D3100, I think it's called. It's the new entry level digital SLR from Nikon, and it's awesome, and I want it, but it costs $700.
I thought it was Nikon. It's not Nikon.
If I remember correctly, Nikon's a Japanese country and...
It's a Japanese company?
Japanese company, sorry. It's a Japanese company. I might be wrong about that. If I'm wrong.
But this is America.
BT dubs, Jamel knows Japanese.
Like, right?
Nikon's a Japanese company.
And yeah, but this is America.
But it's pronounced Ni. It's Nikon, if I were going to be really, like, specific about it.
Yeah, but it's still America.
Okay. But yeah, post-bougie listeners, if you have $700 you're going to lend Jamel Bowie,
We'll put a PayPal button on the page.
PayPal button?
Just for you.
Buy Jamel and your camera.
Jamel's camera fund. Okay. Awesome. Nicole?
I watch entirely too much television, and so my shout-out is going to be for the second season of the HBO series Eastbound and Down, which is...
I didn't know there was a second season.
It starts September 26th. I got one of my friends just randomly happened to show it to me, and I got completely addicted to it. So it's about this out of work baseball player named Kenny Powers who has all of these delusions of grandeur and like moves back to his small town. And I guess this season he's in Mexico, I think. And I just it's really funny. I highly recommend it. They used to have all of the episodes online on HBO for free. HBO.com for free. I don't know if they still do, but if they do, you should check it out. It's really funny.
I'll second that. The first season is really the most bizarre and hilarious thing I've ever seen.
Awesome. I kind of miss Joel because normally he would have like 14 shout outs in one, but I guess we'll play by the rules today.
You can pick up the slack.
I can have 14 shout-outs for in honor of Joel. So my first shout-out is to Vite Orca, which is an album by the Dirty Projectors. It came out last summer. And I'm only shouting it out, one, because they're playing in D.C. next week, and I think I'm going to go. And two, there's a song that like I just can't stop listening to called Two Doves. And like the problem with describing music is that you don't really get it unless you listen to it and like you're into it. So I'm not going to try and describe it. But like their songs don't actually make very much sense, but they have very beautiful imagery. And the voices of the ladies who sing for the Dirty Projectors are amazing. So that's like my main shout out. I don't think I have anything else to shout out though, unfortunately. Oh, I'm going to shout out the start of football season. Because
yes,
because while I don't actually understand or watch football, my roommate Sarah Libby, she actually left our house today to go watch the USC Trojans play their first game of the season in a Trojan shirt, Trojan socks, and like matching underwear, like just, you know, just and she has like this rule where you can't wear new Trojan gear in the middle of the season. You have to like wear it at the beginning of the season to see how it like affects the team or something. So yeah, so she's pretty intense about it. So like shout out to all the football fans out there. I'm starting to understand it just by watching Friday Night Lights, but my knowledge is limited. So
is that show about football? I heard that show is about football.
there's a lot of football in it. Like, I make Sarah explain it to me as we go along.
I'm gonna say that this all makes me a little bit sad because it means it's fall.
That's true, and like it's getting dark out and stuff.
Man, that's the best. I love you. People are weird.
I love fall too, but
summer, like long nights and summer is kind of.
I don't. Fall means winter is coming, and I hate the cold.
I love the cold. I love how it gets dark at 5 o'clock.
Nicole and I were the only ones of us here for the snowpocalypse last winter, too, and that was a little bit insane.
It was awful. I was so angry. I stayed inside my house all day and just stared angrily at my window at all the stupid snow. I hate it.
I mean, it was pretty bad in New Jersey, too.
It was pretty bad in Charlottesville, too.
Like, I had to, like, basically scoot outside the door just so the dog could go outside, and then we'd, like, go back inside.
I had to eat our pet to survive.
I sort of couldn't open my door to my house.
Well, that's because you live in a basement.
It's because I live in a dugout.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, so that will like wrap up our shout-outs. That will actually wrap up the podcast. On behalf of Monica, Janelle, and Nicole, this is Shawnee, and I thank you all for listening. It's been a pleasure. We'll catch you next week, next time.
Same bad time, same bad channel.
8 theme music is 8 by Aeon. You can catch us at postbougie.com.
Done. Your review is really good, Jamal.
Thank you. I actually liked my first a lot better.
You liked your first what?
My first rebuttal to Digby. I thought that was really good.
It was good as well. Good job. You are good on the internet. Okay.